2005, AP 1424, James Gumbs v. Northern State Powers Company, representing Northern State Power Company is Attorney J. Drew Ryberg. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel, Mr. and Mrs. Gumbs, James and Michael Gumbs. I'm Drew Ryberg, and assisting me is Christina M. Bourget in the presentation of this matter. I'm about to pass out some things. I'd ask for permission of the Court to do that with regard to the verdict and also a timeline that would be of assistance, I think, in some of the issues of the case.
Are opposing counsel familiar with what you're going to pass out?
Are you, Your Honor?
No objection. Okay. Are they in the record, counsel?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. The marshal has them. She will pass them out to the court.
These are helpful to us to assist in looking at the verdict as to why we're here, and a timeline refers to the statute of limitations argument that we have in this particular case. The difficulty presenting Northern States in this matter is that effectively there wasn't a contributory negligence question asked, and also there was not a statute of limitations question asked, yet that was a substantial question before the jury throughout the progress of this case. A third issue relates to the timing of the damages and the recovery therefore. It's a position of NSP that case law in Wisconsin says that it dates from the time of actual notice and not before that. The timeline is germane to the statute discussion, which I'll get to in several minutes down the road. We appreciate the opportunity to be here and are thankful for your having taken the case. The question that arises is breadth of the case. What does it mean? Does it matter at all? This may be a stray voltage case, but essentially it's a negligence matter. That's how the case is presented to the jury. That's how the case was tried throughout. It's not that complex, even though we have electrical components to it. The significance of the matter before Your Honor is this, that if allowed to stand, the Court of Appeals decision effectively says that you can't get a contributory negligence question, that the only focus lies with the power company, and that effectively, if you want to say that the contributory question treats the issue of the statute of limitations, you don't get that either. Because when you inquire with regard to the farmer's responsibility, and the question number three that on the verdict says, in the use and or discovery of electricity, and in the context of this case, there was no complaint whatever with regard to the use issue, and the discovery issue related to an arcane issue that whether or not the Gumbses were negligent in not detecting a problem for NSP. So the box that created for NSP essentially is this, that when NSP was out to test in 96 and 99 and established that there was no stray voltage, the context of the instruction and the verdict to the jury said that, NSP, you have to then argue that even though this problem doesn't exist, you have to point to the plaintiff to say that it's his problem for not detecting a problem that did not exist. It doesn't make sense whatever in this particular case. So respectfully, we submit that there's breadth to the issues in the case, both on contributory negligence and also with regard to the statute of limitations. Let me treat those in that order and talk briefly about the facts that apply to the issue of contributory negligence, my first line of analysis in this case. And that's found in the verdict that you have, which is dated in March of 2005, and it's question number three with regard to that. The difficulty presented for the respondent, or the petitioner, I should say, in this case, is that the Allen case came down 6 days before the start of this, came down on February 15. Our case began on February 21 of 2005. And effectively, what the Allen case said was that you could focus the question of contributory on use, and it wasn't beyond that. But there isn't a complaint in the case in Allen or in this case that there was any use mistake on the part of the Gumbses, and we conceded that. There wasn't any issue in this case of on-farm wiring being difficult. That was conceded as well. So then the only question became that discovery issue, and then that led to the box, which was, how is the farmer negligent in terms of the discovery of an issue that NSP said never could have happened in the first place? The injury complained of in this case is a diminished milk production and the herd health concerns that the farmers had. That's what the case was about. And there's lots of inputs with regard to that. With regard to NSP, the assertion was that you goofed and dropped the ball because you had excess neutral to earth voltage there that affected the cows in a way that they couldn't produce as much as they should. NSP's position very clearly was that this is a relatively complicated matter when we talk about milk production and herd health, and there are a number of factors that go into that. I think it might be Exhibit 385 that lists about 15 different factors which apply with regard to this. Nutrition matters. The amount of water matters. The comfort in the stall matters.
Counselor, does contributory negligence go to the question of fault? It seems to me you're arguing contributory negligence as a separate and independent cause of damages.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think that in the context of this matter, we have the production of damages in the diminished milk production and also the herd health. And there are concurrent actors with regard to that. So that Schmidt and Chabot case that you saw by the Court of Appeals that talked about the crank case or transmission, whatever it is not the same kind of thing, because in there, recall that the work by the mechanic was done, then the lady has some notice of a problem and drives for about 4 miles. This is different. At the same time, we have the power company and we have the Gumses managing inputs to the cows, affecting the outcome in the case. So it is a different deal. And it's also different from the enhancement cases that are referenced, like that Masquerade and Volkswagen case as well. It's a different matter altogether.
Mr. Ryberg, what's wrong with question number 3? You spotlighted that for us, and I'd like you to tell me what you think is wrong with it.
Well, it doesn't address anything in terms of contributory negligence. It says use and or discovery. There's no criticism here about the use by the Gumses, none whatever. And with regard to discovery, we don't have a criticism with regard to the fact that they didn't put us in a different situation than that. The discovery issue related only to the matter of their discovery of our electricity on their farm. And it was broader than that in terms of their responsibility for the input. If we have the 15 factors that go to doing that, that is a relevant concern, Your Honor, that it's not just discovery of electricity, but the management, the maintenance of the herd and feeding of the herd.
Well, is it your argument that this question would have been okay if there had been another question on contributory negligence?
Well, I suspect it would, but this didn't answer the question about the statute either, because the statute is directed to a timing kind of concern, and this doesn't answer that question. So respectfully, the answer on the statute of limitations, if you want to treat it that, as the Court did in its opinion, is that a yes answer wouldn't help you because that wouldn't say that the statute ran. And a no answer necessarily doesn't tell you that the statute ran either. It just says that they were reasonable, which is different from a timing kind of question. So it was unhelpful, Your Honor, with regard to the statute of limitations. And
what question would you have asked?
I would have asked as we...
Did you propose that to the trial court?
We did.
Just tell me what you'd ask.
Yes. Okay. Were the Gumses negligent in the care and maintenance and operation of their dairy herd?
Okay.
Was that a cause of damage?
That goes to your contributory negligence issue, as I hear it. I think that, at least as I hear Justice Crooks, which doesn't necessarily mean I heard him correctly, I thought you were going to talk about discovery in terms of the statute of limitations, and that this question is not good enough for the statute of limitations. Or do you want to hold that whole issue for a moment?
Sure, I can do that. Thank you.
I'd prefer if you'd answer it, but...
Okay, I will do that. The question on the statute of limitations was, did they know or should they have known by 6 years before, which was December 21, 2005, I'm sorry, 95, of the role of NSP with regard to damage to their herd? And we had requested that, Your Honor.
All right. And that's for the purposes of
the statute
of limitations. And that's because you are saying this is not answerable under the facts of this case as a question of law.
Right.
The Court of Appeals held
The Court of Appeals held that, it didn't say as a matter of law, but said that you got good treatment by number three, don't complain. It answered the question when it said that if they were reasonable, that meant that they were timely. But those are two different things, respectfully. And I think the Allen case kind of created that kind of problem because judge felt constrained to follow that in the formulation of the verdict questions.
Rather than Colpin.
Yes, okay. Yes. So I think there should have been a question with regard to the responsibility on the part of the farmer. In this particular case, as I said before, they're concurrent actors. They're indivisible damages. The respondent concedes that in this particular case. And the question is relatively whodunit. What's the role of the power company in the contribution of these losses? What's the role with regard to the farmer with regard to that?
Counsel, before you move on, I want to follow up on the Chief's question with respect to the statute of limitations and specifically with respect to the Colpin case. When I look at pages 23 and 24 of the Colpin case, the court basically analyzed the action with respect to two lines of cases in dealing with the statute of limitations, one involving the discovery rule and the other involving the continuum of negligent acts rule. And on page 24 of the decision, the court held that the two line of cases stand for the proposition that in order for a cause of action to accrue, it must be complete. It is complete when the negligent act occurs or the last act occurs in a continuum of negligent acts and when the plaintiff has a basis for objectively concluding that the defendant was the cause of the plaintiff's injuries and damages. The court essentially read those two lines of cases together to come up with the rule of completion for when the action accrues. Now, I understand your argument is on the discovery rule, and I understand your argument is also that there really is no negligence on the part of the company here. But to the extent that the lower court believed to the contrary, are we dealing with a continuum of negligent acts? And if we are, does it matter whether or not the discovery rule was given to the jury in the form that you wanted to have it given?
I don't think we're dealing with a continuum. And I think Colpin at the Supreme Court says that we have a discrete event that triggers. They just said in the Supreme Court decision, I think, that the fellow could not reasonably have known until he had done this analysis, kind of a differential diagnosis and walked through things. So I think it's a different matter, Your Honor.
Well, I want to press you on this because as I read the decision, Colpin basically is decided on the basis of the discovery rule. But it says you can't ignore both rules. They both coexist. And if you have a continuum of negligence, the act is, at least the cause of action does not accrue until that last act occurs and you have the discovery. And in Colpin, the last act had already accrued. As I understand the facts of this case, at least the allegations were that the negligence was ongoing. So do we really have to reach the discovery question with respect to the statute of limitations if the negligent acts are continuing?
I think you do, Your Honor, in this sense that the allegations and the expert testimony against NSP were that they had a faulty distribution system and that they had a line that was dated like in 1937. And it was that this was a problem that these people had. And it wasn't really treated as a continuum kind of issue, we believe. What the court, I think, the Honorable Trial Court did was to say, gee, if I look at Allen, it says that a question about use is sufficient to deal with anything that relates to timeliness, and I'll put that in here. But the court, I think, in Mr. Lawrence's brief at page 22, talks about the fact that he was satisfied as a matter of law, Judge Grau was, that these people have been reasonable in what they had done. So it's only the Court of Appeals that goes back to say that we believe that the analysis with regard to question three would have treated the statute question as well, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, I want to return to the contributory negligence aspect. And just before Justice Butler asked his question, you said something to the effect that you want to know what is the role of the farmer with regard to the losses, and what is the role of NSP? So I'm kind of bringing you back to that, if I may. My first question is, when you were referring to with regard to the losses, What do you mean by losses?
The losses in this case primarily were the diminished milk production and the herd health. So to the extent the farmer has difficulty in the management of the herd or the health science and so on, it makes a difference with regard to that. But for the court to have concluded in the Gums case on appeal that the input of the farmer would not make any difference doesn't make rational sense for if, for example, the Gumses elected not to feed for a month and a half. Could it be said seriously that that would not be an input with regard to the herd health or the milk production?
So much of life, in my observation, is a matter of lens. How wide is the lens? How narrow is the lens in terms of how you look at an issue, how you analyze an issue, or I suppose how you look at life? You defined losses, in response to my question, as loss of milk production and the ill health of the herd. But that's not what the jury was asked in the special verdict. They weren't asked about losses. And I need you to, I'll say this in a statement, but need you to comment and challenge me, if you will. They weren't asked about, you know, losses generally to the milk production that may encompass that they didn't feed them as much as they should have. They weren't asked generally about the ill health. The questions posed to the jury were specific, and I refer to question 2. Was the negligence a cause of the damage attributable to harmful levels of electricity to the Gumses? And again, when you get to the damage question itself, when the jury awarded damages, they were awarding damages, it appears, for something very specific, for damages attributable to harmful levels of electricity, not for damages that may be attributable to not feeding as often, more feed, more milk, you know, pretty basic. So this jury was given a verdict to answer specific questions. As drafted, where does your contributory negligence argument as to, let's say, not feeding them continuously to produce the milk, that is, the management of the herd, fit into the way this question was framed?
Exactly. That's a problem that NSP had. We couldn't put that on the verdict. There was no line with respect to that. Were the damages discrete, you could make the argument that we know what the harmful levels attributable to electricity are. But that wasn't able to be done. And so the jury had a number of damages that it had to sort out in terms of who contributed to those.
Yeah, but why are you complaining if you were at the jury was asked and you, let's say, are obligated to pay only those damages that are attributable to harmful levels of electricity?
I think because we never received an opportunity to argue the responsibility of the farmer, and if the damages in milk production are $901,000, and if the return of the jury on that one question in the verdict is $249,000, that's 28% of the damages that they sought. We make the statement that it's 72% of the responsibility of the farmer in respect to that. If that question's on the verdict, 72-28, plaintiff loses. So we don't get the benefit of the bar in that case.
If I may, one follow-up question, because I'm still having a little difficulty with this. Can you tell me what evidence was presented with regard to the plaintiff's negligence attributable to harmful levels of electricity? You know, what kind of contributory negligence evidence is there in the record with regard to the plaintiff attributable to harmful levels of electricity?
In respect to that, Your Honor, NSP maintains that there was concern that Mr. Gums had in 92 He had word from the nutritionist, in fact, a specific recommendation in 93 to have this checked out by electricians. In 94, he would have had the farm rewired for the TMR unit, and it was reported at that time that the electrical wiring in the farm was A-OK. So these kinds of issues were the sorts of things that he was aware of. Maybe that's more of a statute of limitations analysis of
it
what
we're talking
about.
It seems to me that goes more to whether or not the question three, were the gums negligence in the discovery of the electricity on the farm.
You point to the dilemma for NSP. We couldn't have specific contributory negligence arguments that we could have returnable on number three. We could argue it wasn't I, and a lot of these are allocable over here. But if the jury was able to make a judgment about the discreteness of the electrical damages, this would be fine. But you couldn't do that. The record doesn't admit of that.
Well, did you try and bring in, I have not read the entire record, okay? Did you try and bring in a vet who said these are caused by bad nutrition, that the damages are caused by, cows like people get diseases, no fault of anybody, and he just was unlucky, and once it spread through the herd, he had a problem. Did you bring him that kind of evidence?
Thank you. We did, Your Honor. We had.
And that was all allowed to the jury?
It was all allowed to be. Right.
And you argued it was the farmer's fault.
I did. But I can't get that into answer number three well, and I don't get the benefit of any kind of comparison at that point. That's my hang-up.
You would have preferred that the question, that the following question be asked. How much damages did the farmers suffer in their herd, right? And how much did the farmers show in their evidence?
Yes.
How much did they?
Well, they are, on the milk production, they said 901.
Okay. So you would have wanted to say how much were the farmers damaged in their herd during this time period?
Yes.
The answer would have been 900,000 is their damage. That's what you would have wanted. Then you would have wanted to say how much of that attributable to the northern state as a result of its negligence in harmful levels of electricity.
Yes.
And there would have been a percent. And then you would have wanted to say, and how much is attributable to the farmer for its negligence in attributable to harmful levels of electricity? And then you would have wanted another question that said, and how much is attributable to the farmer's negligence in farming?
Well,
not related to maybe the negative, not related to the electrical harmful levels of electricity. Is that what you wanted, that kind of series?
I think,
if you don't like my phrasing.
Right. I think it's maybe simpler than that, Your Honor. It's like a negligence case. In a medical negligence, the plaintiff can be negligent, and then you have five questions. Was the doctor negligent? Was it causal? Was the plaintiff negligent? Was it causal? Then you have a comparison. The same thing would have applied.
What is his total damages?
Yeah, and what are the damages?
I just stated it.
Yes, and then you apply those percentages vis-a-vis the finding of the jury.
And you're saying that by limiting the damage question to just negligence, the assumption is made there may have been other damages not due to harmful levels of electricity, and that's damaging to you because if it was due to contributory negligence, then it depends on whose negligence was more harmful.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was the missing question as far as you're concerned. You can't shortcut it this way. That's your position, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. And essentially, it's like the medical negligence where the plaintiff may not be the expert person with respect to medicine, but he or she can be at fault, and the farmer may not be expert about electricity, but he can be at fault. And to carve this out from every other negligence case in the state is not a reasonable thing to have done.
And you say in medical malpractice, you wouldn't have said how much negligence, how much is damages caused by the doctor's harmful.
You'd ask about the damages.
What's the damages? Okay.
The usual question number six would be, if you had the previous five, what sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate the Gumses in these respects, then itemize the four, as you would have in the medical negligence matter.
Counselor, I have your proposed special verdict
before me. And I don't see anything on there that addresses when the Gumpses knew or should have known of the cause of the damages. Do you have a question that you can refer me to that you think answers the concerns about statute of limitations defense that's on the proposed special verdict?
Judge, is that on I think
I got it out of Appendix 21, and I can't tell you whose appendix because I always take these things apart and make my own book. But
I think question 9 answers that, does it not?
Did the Gumpses know, or with reasonable diligence, should they have known or discovered that the electricity was a cause of damage? Okay, fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, to the extent that you want to treat that as a statute of limitations question, the statute of limitations ought to represent the bar. But what happens when you treat this as a contributory negligence question, which the court did, is that it then becomes subject to comparative negligence, which means that if it's 28 or something like that, then there can be an offset with respect to that. But if you asked it cleanly the way it should be, the timing kind of question, that can represent a bar. So not only did NSP lose the benefit of the bar on contributory, it lost the opportunity for any question about the statute and the possibility of a bar with regard to that. And there were fact questions galore with regard to that. And that's the purpose of my timetable, and I see my time is up.
Counsel, may I ask just one question?
Yes, Your Honor.
In the contributory negligence jury instruction that the judge gave, 1007 and then in 1052, it speaks in there of the duty of the electric company to exercise its requisite care, and then it also speaks to the duty to the farmer to exercise the farmer's level of care to discover, correct, and maintain a practice on the farm. Are you saying that question 3 really relates to the contributory negligence and question and jury instruction 1052 rather than addressing any sort of discovery issue because it fails to reference before December 21, 1995?
Yes. It's a timing kind of question. And if you look there on that paragraph 4 of that, Your Honor, on 1052, it talks about practices and so on. Did the farmer err with regard to his practices? That's kind of a contributory question that we would have wanted. But that wouldn't be something that is returnable on answer 3 because that doesn't deal with the issue of the electricity or discovery of that. It has nothing to do with that. But is primarily a significant factor in terms of the herd health and how the animals produce.
Thank you.
Reiberg, why don't you indicate what it is you're trying to establish with this chart so that Mr. Lawrence will have a full opportunity to rebut that.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our position looking at the chart is that in 91, it said that the problems commenced with regard to the farm, and it's a cow skittish, uneven milk out, reluctance to enter the farm, that kind of thing. In 92, Mr. Gumbs, James, has some concern about stray voltage and said that he initiated that discussion with Mr. Tolk, the nutritionist. Mr. Tolk is then there in the summer of 93. He's brought out representatives to address the herd health, the veterinary situation, the nutrition aspect, representatives of Pfizer, and it's his conclusion after all of that, and he tells Mr. Gumbs in the summer of 93 the problem is stray voltage, and he recommends that they see two electricians. I think it's Mr. Ritchie and Mr. Bean. And it's not until May of 96 that Mr. Ritchie is brought in at all. So effectively, even though James had the concerns, brought them forward, he said to Mr. Tolk in 92, and there was clear notice in 93 for Mr. Tolk, and Mr. Klein ruled out the farm with regard to a source of the voltage, that process of elimination analysis is relatively well along. And it's unjustified to wait between 92 when you have some concerns and 96 to act. And we analogize to those medical negligence cases, Clark and Erdman, the Fritz and McGrath, and the Webb and Oculera, where they talk about strictly possibilities. And so our concern on the statute is that carved out separately is something in stray voltage, which is that until you make the fix, and until the remedy is established and you know that that works, that the statute does not commence to run, cannot be the law. That's not fair and reasonable. And it treats this situation differently from those minors that you saw in the John Doe case, from Mr. Webb with regard to his notice when it was framed in terms of possibility. So in that regard, Your Honor, we think that the concern we have is that the statute of limitations just relatively goes out the window if you can say that it can't be said to commence until you identify with precision like an expert, even though the cases say that's not required, and then you have effected a solution to that and you can establish that production has returned. That's not what the law is, respectfully.
What if the court were to buy your analysis here based on the chart? What do we do then with the continuing negligence concept?
Well, I think that doesn't have application for what we're talking about here, and I think what it says is that the power company gets a question with regard to it, at least a question, although the brief may have asked for a summary judgment to say that as a matter of law, this was not reasonable diligence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryberg. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Scott Lawrence, representing the plaintiffs, the Gumses. Counsel.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The Gumses are here with counsel in the second, third rows and over on the wall. Mr. Cook, who's with me, and Ms. Andrea Good have the pleasure of representing them.
May I just interrupt you for a moment and then in accordance with the tradition of this court in our regard for a coordinate branch of government, I would like to introduce Representative Jerry Petrosky, who is here listening in, at all times, the public, but including our fellow constitutional officers are welcome.
Yes, he is. Thank you, Your Honor. First, with respect to the statute of limitations issue, basic law, the burden of proof to establish the statute of limitations rests on the defendant. It's an affirmative defense. There's some suggestion to the contrary in NSP's brief, which I think has been abandoned in the reply brief and certainly has not been argued by Mr. Ryberg. The burden of proof was simply not met. In fact, it miserably failed from NSP's standard in this case. And the question under the Culpin, or Culpin, it's pronounced both ways, case, and the other cases of this court, including the very recent one since the briefs, the Doe versus Archdiocese case from a couple months ago, is did the plaintiffs know, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence, should they have known the nature of their injury and the defendant's part in causing it within the applicable period, 6 years in this case. NSP claims that it was entitled to such an instruction in question despite the fact that it is undisputed that Gumses did not have objective evidence that NSP was causing harmful stray voltage on their farm until May of 1996 when they and Mr. Ritchie tested. They said no, Mr. Ritchie said yes. Despite the fact NSP could never identify any electrical problem on the Gumses farm from any source and maintained that position right up through the trial of this matter. Despite the fact that Gumses aren't electrical professionals, they don't have training and experience in electricity, and they don't have access to NSP's system to test it. Despite the fact that it's undisputed that Gumses went through a rigorous process to attempt to identify the problems in their herd with an electrician very early on after Mr. Tolk identified it and said their wiring's in good shape, Jim Gumses testified that he had no idea, didn't even imagine it, that if there was an electrical problem, it could be the utility at that time, and not until Mr. Ritchie came in 96.
Counsel, when did the statute of limitations start to run? Did it ever start to run?
Yes, as of May of 1996, when Mr. Ritchie...
May 6, Peterson Tolk letters, is that it? Not that it makes much difference but as to the 6 years, because you started in 01. Is it the Ritchie inspection?
It would be, Your Honor, because that is the first expert inspection or information of any type that connected the problem to NSP. Gumses' own electrician looked, said, I can't find a problem. Your farm wiring is in very good shape several years before that. The Gumses worked, they changed nutritionists. They changed feeding methods. They modernized their feeding methods in this time period. And their veterinarian, Dr. Teresa Peterson of Merrill, went through a long and agonizing process of testing the animals in this herd for many different things. There's been enough blood work in this herd in these 3 years to take a much bigger herd through a lot more years. And eventually, in 1996, she is suspecting stray electricity. That's when people further away than the outside electricians were called in, and NSP was called in. Mr. Ritchie said yes, NSP said no.
Counsel, do you think, what jury verdict, special verdict question, gives to the jury the issue of the statute of limitations?
There is no question on the verdict form that's directed to the statute of limitations, Chief Justice. It's happenstance that the formulation of the contributory negligence question with a no answer, it wouldn't with a yes answer, resolves the issue because it found that the Gumbos exercised ordinary care with respect to discovering electrical conditions on their farm, even if from an off-farm source. I'm mixing the instruction and the verdict question together here. At all times, not just in the 6 years before the six-year period before the case was filed. In other words, it encompasses, with a no answer, it encompasses more than the issue on the statute of limitations.
Mr. Lawrence, do you think that that's appropriate? Question three looks to me, on the face of it, as a compound question. It's asking about the use, and it's asking about discovery. Is that appropriate?
It may be a close call, Your Honor. It's directed at electrical matters only. And in fact, I think that was incorporated the last morning of trial. I think it's probably within the trial court's discretion. One could certainly make an argument that a better practice would be to separate them out. But under Judge Grau, more broadly on appropriateness, we concede that would not be an appropriate question to address the statute of limitations issue if there were credible evidence to support an answer in favor of NSP. That I'll concede. The problem NSP has is that there was no credible evidence to support an answer in their favor on that issue. And the evidence in this case tracks, as in many of these cases, the evidence in the Culpin case.
I don't understand this. They may never have been negligent in discovering it, but on the other hand, they, under the law, you might say that they should have had reasonable grounds to discover it in, I'm just picking a date, 91. And so they weren't negligent. They found that out in 91, and the jury doesn't know that that was all related to 6 years. You know, they were never negligent.
I don't think so, Chief Justice.
Okay.
The semantic difference, if you will, the difference in the language that's been adopted in the case law is one between ordinary care, definition of negligence, and reasonable diligence in discovering the problem. For statute of limitations purposes. Is there a difference between those two phrases? I can't find one. In fact, after verdict, NSP moved to change the jury's answer to question three as a matter of law, and their motion says, well, of course the answer to this should be yes, because it's clear the Gumbos didn't exercise reasonable diligence. I think trial counsel for NSP acknowledged the equivalence of ordinary care and reasonable diligence when they made that motion.
Mr. Lawrence, could I ask you, the Chief said, when did the statute of limitations begin to run? Suppose Mr. Ritchie and NSP had not been brought in until May 1997, and all the things that happened in May 1996 happened in May 1997. Would you say then that the statute of limitations began to run in May 1997?
I very likely would on these facts, particularly if the herd veterinarian had concluded about the same time as she did in May 1996 that you better stake the stray voltage thing further. There's a whole panoply of people in here. There's two nutritionists. There's one before Mr. Ritchie. There's one electrician, two including him. And there's the herd veterinarian. It's only Mr. Polk, the earlier nutritionist, who said, I think the stray voltage may be the problem here, which is what triggered Gumbos to bring in their own electrician to test who couldn't identify a problem. Now, had this gone until May of 1997, I guess it depends on all the facts that perhaps that would happen in between times. But nonetheless, the burden of proof would still rest on NSP to establish, by the greater weight of credible evidence, to produce some credible evidence anyway, that the statute had run. NSP produced not one witness to testify that a reasonable dairyman in the position of the Gumses back in 93, 94, 95, early 96, would have taken more steps and would have figured out that this was an NSP problem. That's perhaps understandable, excuse me, because NSP at the same time was saying there's no electrical problem there whatsoever. And they said that right up through the trial of this matter. Now, could they carry their burden on the statute of limitations question if in 97 or any other year they're still saying that and the Gumses chose to believe them for a while?
In 93, 94, and 95, NSP came out and said there's no problem?
No, 96, they started to they came out first and said no problem throughout, right through the trial of this matter. So if we're moving into the future, could the Gumses be faulted and found to be barred by the statute of limitations because they chose to believe NSP instead of somebody else? I mean, this is it gets to be almost absurd because NSP.
I argue that it's a matter of law that your clients fit within the statute of limitations. I thought that you were going to come in and really rely on Colpin. I mean, there are some differences, but you could argue that they are really the same, and in that case, matter of law.
And they are, Your Honor. And this Court recently affirmed the concept that on the statute of limitations issue on undisputed facts, whether the statute has been exceeded or not becomes a question of law, and that reasonable inferences are what is a reasonable inference is also a matter of law, and that's out of the Doe versus Archdiocese opinion from 2 months
only
ago.
Only if there's only one reasonable inference. If there are several reasonable inferences from undisputed facts, it ordinarily goes to the jury, I think.
Furthermore, getting to Colpin, if you take Mr. Ryberg's timeline and you read the Colpin decision and put it up next to it and back the timeline up about 14 years, you'll find that the Colpin facts just about fit into exactly the same spots, which is the analysis that Judge Grau went through. There, you had a jury verdict that, on the instruction given back then, which, of course, this Court dealt with and perhaps changed the template for in Colpin, the jury found that the statute was exceeded, and this Court changed that answer as a matter of law under the objective knowledge test. We have essentially the same fact pattern here. You can make a few little distinctions, but basically the timeline slots in here. It was in Colpin, it was 10 years from the first symptoms until they filed suit, for example. Same here. And you go right down the line and you'll see a similar sequence of facts.
Unless the Court has further comments on the statute of limitations, I wonder if I can move you into the contributory negligence.
Sure.
Unless you have
finished.
Go ahead. Justice Prosser.
You did have the Colpin decision in 1991. I mean, knowledge evolves and grows. Is that a factor here or not?
It could be. It could, but again, that gets to the burden, Justice, because we had nobody on behalf of NSP, or we had no witness whatsoever come in and say that a reasonable dairyman in these circumstances should have known that it was stray voltage and that NSP was the cause of it. Nobody said that from before 12/21/95. Not a single witness. They simply didn't meet their burden. Now, with respect to the formulation of the verdict, it's...
Okay, let me just say I was founded... Justice Bradley's question about the fact that the damages were limited to the level of electricity or the stray voltage. And I thought, yeah, you've limited the damages, so you're just going to look at these damages and you're going to attribute negligence and contributory negligence to the damages for the stray voltage. And then your opposing counsel said, hey, that's not right. That's not what you do in Med-Mal. You say what are your total damages, and then you allocate the total damages, and you don't cut off the damages to just Med-Mal. And that it matters how you do it because of the concept that if the plaintiff is more negligent than the defendant, you get zero damages. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a straight comparative negligence.
Yes, it does, but it's black-letter law that it's the occurrence complained of to which the contributory negligence or the comparative negligence of the parties should relate.
How do I make up my mind between Justice Bradley's statement of what the trial court did, which I agree with, that's what the trial court did, and opposing counsel's view that says, hey, why is this any different than Med-Mal?
Well, if you had a Med-Mal case where the plaintiff was being accused of being contributorily negligent because their lifestyle or their choices in how they live caused the condition that the malpractice of the doctor enhanced, the court has rejected that rationale. The Farm Bureau, in their amicus brief, has a good analogy, I think, which can be expanded on a little bit. If you have a neighbor to a farm that starts a grass fire, and the grass fire gets out of control and burns the barn down, is it a defense on contributory negligence that the barn was poorly maintained? Or let's take it one step further, if the barn is full of cows, and half of them die and half of them have smoke inhalation damage, is it contributory negligence because the farmer may not have used the most modern dairying practices in milking them both before and after the incident? No, it's a question of causation and damages and perhaps mitigation, but not of contributory negligence in producing the loss or the occurrence complained of. To pull off what Mr. Ryberg proposes, we would have to establish what level of production, what level of herd health, et cetera, that some hypothetically non-negligent farmer were to establish. There was no testimony of what that standard of ordinary care is. In fact, Dr. Houston, their veterinary farm management expert, at the end, after saying I don't like this and I don't like that about the way Gumbs' farm, said, but they're doing very well. And they're doing very well because they're conservative in spending money, and they work harder than practically anybody I've ever seen. He didn't say, never did he say, they didn't meet the level of ordinary care of a reasonable farmer. Again, I don't think they carried their burden on that issue, even if it were appropriate. The record sites are in our brief. And again, I just don't think NSP carried any burden on that, even if it were an appropriate question, and I don't think it was.
Why didn't the jury give you $900,000, do you think?
I'm not sure. They gave us a total, including the nuisance damages, of about $530,000.
That's about half.
Yeah, or a little lower.
Why'd they knock it down?
They probably simply didn't believe that the Gumbses would have achieved the level of production that our economists thought they would have with the help of some of the veterinarians and other farm management experts who testified. But obviously they thought there was a considerable amount of damage. A related aspect is the nuisance damages, the annoyance and inconvenience damages. They are unique to nuisance claims. A nuisance is an unreasonable invasion of the rights of another in the use or enjoyment of land. It's been established in the restatement and by much case law of this court, including the Vogel case with respect to stray voltage cases in particular. Now, it's pretty clear that farming practices are not, good or bad, are not going to invade the rights and the use or enjoyment of land of the farmer. How can we have a nuisance case which involves invasions of the rights and the use and enjoyment of land and compare it with something that doesn't cause that invasion and the use and enjoyment of land? It doesn't make any sense. And ultimately, the formulation of the verdict is discretionary. Judge Grau went to great lengths to make the verdict consistent, right down to the aggravation language in the damage instruction. Only damages caused or aggravation of underlying conditions, if any, due to the stray electricity. There is nothing in there that would permit the jury to award damages for something other than the incremental damage from the stray electricity, if you will. He worked real hard on that. We quoted lengthy portions of the instruction conference in our brief because I think it's very important to your decision in this case. And ultimately, it is a discretionary decision. Even as long as the issues are set forth, generally this court has affirmed a trial court's use of that discretion if appropriate. I should get to the last issue briefly anyway, and that is that NSP asks at this late juncture, after not having requested a special verdict question or instruction limiting damages to before 1996, that this court cause this case to be retried because no such limiting instruction was given. Well, first of all, it's been waived. The Court of Appeals.
What was waived?
The request for an instruction and verdict question limiting damages to 1996 on. The NSP did not submit a special verdict question or instruction on that issue. They'd raised it on summary judgment before, but they dropped it at trial. Now, the Court of Appeals addressed it, even though we took the position it had been waived, and found in our favor, citing, among other things, the Court of Appeals decision in the Vogel case, which was reversed on other issues, not that one, by this court back in the mid-90s. But ultimately, limitations on damages of negligent parties involve public policy analyses by this court that a party should not be held liable, even though they may be found causally negligent. There was no such analysis entered into in NSP's brief. They said a 1955 case, when duty analysis was somewhat different than it is now, of the Snyder v. Oakdale Electric Cooperative case, where a house burned down, the homeowner blamed the utility because they'd hooked up the power when there were defects in the house wiring, not the utility wiring. And this court said there's no duty if there's no notice of the problems in the house wiring when they hooked them up. Now, that's got very little to do with this case, where the defects are the 1937 copper weld conductor and the hardware that goes with it that was installed to serve the Gums Farm at the dawn of rural electrification during the Great Depression. It's been known to be prone to stray voltage problems for a long time. Public Service Commission of Wisconsin's had a program to phase it out and eliminate it for many years. Nonetheless, NSP continued to use it here right up through and beyond the trial of this matter. In terms of foreseeability of harm and the fact that every actor owes a duty to the whole world to be non-negligent for acts that may foreseeably cause harm, even if the exact nature of the harm and the exact identity of the person to be damaged is unknown, none of that's been gone through here. So in addition to waiver, we think NSP is wrong on the merits. Furthermore, there is a case which probably should have been cited in some of our briefs, but wasn't, that addresses a very similar issue of voltage transients coming off a power line burning down a bowling alley, and that's from the early 90s, Beacon Bowl versus Wisconsin Electric Power Company, 176 Wiz Second 740, a 1983 decision of this court, where the court, in the face of a full set of public policy arguments, went through the analysis and found there was no reason to limit liability. It was poor maintenance on the power line that led to the voltage surges that came in and burned the bowling alley down. There certainly was no notice in that case because it all happened at the same time, like a more typical tort case than stray electricity. But for the same public policy reasons, the NSP's request that damages be limited to before notice, when the damage is very foreseeable due to the old copper weld conductor and its known propensity to damage dairies, should be rejected by this court.
Causes stray voltage.
We're going to be out of time by the time I finish that, Justice. There's a number of ways of distributing electricity in the countryside. The one commonly used in our part of the world, in most but not all of this country, is called a multiple grounded Y system, where the wire returning to the substation is grounded to earth at multiple points. Now, industrial plants, your house, and farms, if they're wired to code, aren't wired that way. They don't use a return wire as a ground wire. They essentially have one wire doing two functions. And as a result, current's conducted into the ground, both through the customer's premises, because typically the power company neutral or return wire is bonded to the customer premises. That's the connection the isolation transformer breaks. But it doesn't get rid of all the other current going into the ground and all the other grounding connections on the system, which are many around the farm. So you have the electricity being conducted through the earth. Some of it gets in the proximity of the dairy cows. The dairy cows don't like it. It's very subtle. It's very insidious. It causes things that have other causes also.
Let me ask this. Suppose we all have dairy farms up here, and on the same highway, and the utility is supplying electricity to all of our farms, but only my farm has high voltage problems. Why is that?
Oh, there could be a multiplicity of causes, Justice Prosser. Your farm may simply be a much better earth connection than the other. It may be a bigger farm with more barn steel going into concrete, deeper wells, maybe several wells, all of which are bonded back to the electrical system and ground the distribution system. But the ironic thing about that scenario is if typically, and this is, you'll see this in the PSC dockets, if the neutrals are isolated at your farm to help that problem, less current goes to ground at your place. But if nothing's done to improve the wire and the hardware out on the road, more of it's going through the neighbors. It's kind of like you plug one hole in a pipe, but there are other holes, and now the rate of flow out of the other holes is greater.
Okay. Well, if I'm kind of suspecting stray voltage as a problem on my farm, and I bring someone in who says, you have no electrical problems with your own equipment here, what inference should I draw from that?
Well, one inference you could draw would be that maybe that person's wrong, but the other is maybe it's something else, which is what the Gumses did when they worked so intensely with their veterinarian over about a two-year period. She says she doesn't like to say stray voltage until she's eliminated other things, and she went through this significant process of laboratory testing before in 1996. She said, yeah, I think you better have stray voltage tested. I think that's probably the problem because, among other things, the immunity of this herd is not in good shape. There's no single underlying disease problem that seems to be causing it. There's a whole host of secondary invaders, if you will. In other words, bacteria, for example, that are in the environment that are usually innocuous and most of the time don't make cows sick, that are causing problems because of the decreased immunity. And at that point, she said, I think you got stray voltage, and the Gumses has jumped on it, and they did something about it. She wasn't at that point until 1996. Now, I wanted to cite one other case that's not set forth in our briefs on the level of deference, the standard of review, if you will, when an issue is not submitted to a jury, even though it's raised by the pleading, when the trial judge, upon the trial judge's analysis, he finds there is not sufficient credible evidence there is no credible evidence to support the claim. And that is a series of cases that ends with Haase, H-A-A-S-E, v. Badger Mining, which is a 2004 decision of this court, 274 Wiz Second 143, where this court said, in essence, that because of the trial judge's better ability to analyze the evidence, because he was present and could hear the witnesses, he's in a better position to make the judgment call as to whether there is sufficient credible evidence to submit the issue. And although the ultimate issue is one of law, i.e., is there any credible evidence which could support an answer of yes to the verdict question, the trial judge's analysis is due considerable deference. And I think that's the situation you have here. Judge Grau heard 2 weeks of testimony, a couple hundred exhibits, about 25 witnesses, and he ultimately rejected NSP's position that it had any credible evidence to say the Gumses should have figured this out sooner, even though we've been asserting right up through this trial that there was never a problem for them to figure out. It's the dilemma Mr. Ryberg talked about, but it's a dilemma that by which NSP wants to have it both ways. And we don't think the law should support such a cynical position. I mean, you can argue in the alternative, but I don't know how they can expect anybody to believe them. Certainly to believe both alternatives by the time it's done. I think under the standard of the Haase case, Judge Grau was well within his or made a ruling that deserves a lot of deference simply because NSP's position was, frankly, preposterous.
How are they having it both ways? Why don't you tell me about that?
They're saying there never was a problem with electricity of any type on this farm, ours, the farmers, anybody's. At the same time, they're saying that they presented sufficient credible evidence to get to the jury the issue of there was a problem, it was coming from NSP, and you, the Gumses, should have figured it out before 12/21/95. There is no way to reconcile those positions. They are 180 degrees opposite. And they went for the brass ring, if you will, of trying to have the jury find no credible evidence or no sufficient evidence that the Gumses were harmed at all. And in doing so, they necessarily dropped the ball on the other issue. That's my point. The yellow light's on, not the red light, but I think I'm done. Unless
Are there any statements on this chart that you would attack?
A little bit, not a lot. In 1992, and Mr. Ryberg has indicated James Gumbs has concerns of potential stray electricity. He certainly talked to Mr. Tolt by 1993, but Mr. Gumbs' testimony in that regard, it's record 158, the fourth day of the trial transcript, page 197, was as follows. Mr. Ryberg asked him a question. Now, there's been some testimony that's been developed in this case that sometime around 1992, Mr. Tolk suggested you have the farm tested for stray voltage. Do you recall that answer? Yes, roughly the date, I don't know. I don't think that 92 is chiseled in stone. But 92, 93, he's in the ballpark anyway.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Justice Bradley.
Before Justice Prosser asked a question, you indicated that Judge Grau found that there was no credible evidence to say that they should have discovered it sooner. I don't understand that statement as it relates to question 3 of the special verdict. Question 3 of the special verdict says, were the Gumbses negligence in the, discovery of electricity on the farm? The jury instruction given with regard to that question was, I think, the following. The failure to exercise ordinary care to discover an unsafe electrical condition on the farm can also be negligence. And then it goes on. So it seems to me that question number 3, at least arguably, encompasses the concept that there was evidence to say that they should have discovered it sooner. The court didn't answer that question as a matter of law. The jury was asked, were they negligent in failing to discover it sooner? And the jury, of course, with regard to question 3, answered no, neither. They were not negligent in the use or in the discovery. That they were not negligent in the use or discovery of electricity on their farm. So how can you make that statement?
Because Judge Grau's statute of limitations analysis takes the analysis of the Colpeen standard up to 12/21/95, not for all time, not up to the present, up to the time of trial. Mm-hmm. Again, it's different. It's different time periods.
Okay, talking about statute of limitations as opposed to any kind of
correct.
When
I was saying his discretion should be upheld with respect to the statute of limitations question.
Okay.
That's for that limited time period.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Ryberg.
May it please the court. Let me review the comments in the order in which they were made, beginning with the statute of limitations. Counsel refers to page 197 of the testimony by Mr. Gumbs. I refer you to page 209 at record 158, where Mr. Gumbs has said in 92 He brought up the subject of stray voltage to Mr. Tolk, and Mr. Tolk then did the analysis that I had discussed before between 92 and 93, then after that had the Klein analysis. So there was lots of objective evidence for the jury to have considered in this matter. Counsel chides for saying that we didn't have an expert come testify in this case, that this was a failure to act more timely by the farmer. That's a fact question for the jury and one where one cannot have expert testimony in a case like that. Counsel chides with regard to Dr. Houston to say that he didn't say that they were negligent, but that's not what an expert can do in the context of this case. It's not uniquely like a medical negligence case where you're talking about an anesthesiologist and there you have to have some expert testimony on that point. These are fact matters for the jury to make a judgment based upon the factors. Dr. Houston, for example, had like 15 or 18 from that Exhibit 385. Now, weighing all of those factors together, do those indicate whether or not there was a failure to exercise ordinary care? So expert testimony is not necessary with regard to the diligence question insofar as the farmer. With regard to damages and causation, yes, but not diligence.
Counsel, you talk about the objective evidence with respect to the diligence question. As I understand the facts, the Gumses had at least information from a nutritionist and perhaps suspicion regarding stray voltage, but I'm not aware of any evidence that they had back in 1993 that linked the stray voltage to NSP. Am I correct with that?
I think that's not accurate in the sense that it was said by Mr. Tolk that it was an outside phenomenon which came from the power company. And so if there was some question, clearly they got resolved in 94 when the wiring person, the expert they have, the electrician, Mr. Klein, said, it's not your wiring. So now you know it's an electrical kind of issue and there's no response with regard to that. But when you do the isolation transformer, which was done here, effectively you're saying this is an NSP matter relatively, and so there's even further notice to them in May of 96 to have acted. But this period between 92, 93, and 96 not to act and then wait even after that until December of 01 to commence any kind of a suit is not tolerable with respect to that, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you get
yes.
to the finale, you liken this to a Med-Mal case.
Well, a car case, too.
Okay, let me take a car case. Let me take actually just the damages part of the car case. Let me take a shoulder pre-existing condition. And arguably here there's evidence of a pre-existing condition that causes damages. I mean, there might be evidence that they didn't feed them properly, nutrition, timeliness of feeding, pre-existing condition. But the tortfeasor is responsible for only the damages caused by the accident, which aggravated the pre-existing condition. Why isn't that akin to this question and what these folks were awarded? That is, the jury in the pre-existing condition shoulder case would be asked for the amount of damages that were caused by the injury, not for the, the person who could hardly move the arm to begin with, but just that much that was caused by the injury. Why isn't that the same here? The jury was asked, what were the damages caused by this electrical problem?
Because it's not so discreet as you might be able to say on the shoulder. We talked about the damages in the four or five respects that the jury had to look at in the case, and it wasn't so discreet as to be able to indicate that. And up until 91, for what, the 10-year period, they'd done very well. Now things weren't going so well. And you've got a new herd every three, 4 years, and you've got different factors that a person has to be aware of. So the pre-existing analogy is not directly in point, Your Honor, and you've got these actors at the same time working and causing these kinds of situation, and then you need to assess relatively a whodunit in terms of responsibility with regard to that. So I think the car case is a good example because this may be stray voltage and the neutral to earth may be a complicated phenomena to pick up. But the analyses on the statute of limitations and contributory negligence are across the state in every case that you hear. And there's no reason to give this a break when the law should not allow something like that.
Counselor, I have one more question I have to ask you because you haven't had a chance to respond to the last issue, which is that you didn't ask for a jury question on only assessing damages from 96 forward when there was notice given to Northern States Power. And the statement was also made that you did make that part of a motion for summary judgment, but you didn't do anything about it at trial. Would you address that issue for me, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe in the instruction conference we asked for a question like that, didn't have a specific denomination that this would be the question.
Mm-hmm. So we did ask for a limiting question in the instruction conference.
We did, but then also when Mr. Baer testified on Monday, which would have been the 28th, we said at the outset of that. Now, it's not right to go back in the period before 96. We renewed it at that time. And he was the farm person who talked about what the damages were and said they were $901,000.
Do you have, was there a requested jury instruction that you can point to in the record then? Special verdict?
To answer your question, I didn't have that, but we had of record preceding Dr. Baer in the instruction conference that we think and respectfully submit that it should date from 96 and after and not before. If I may take just another minute, Your Honor.
Yes, go ahead, Counsel.
On the question of Dr. Houston, to say that Dr. Houston says they're really good farmers and how can you divine that the guys aren't good farmers and that kind of thing, in the very question they have from their brief, they say in here that at the expense of good herd health, they've been able to economize and do well economically. So by definition, they're shortcutting in order to save money. And that's not an appropriate analysis by counsel to have made that statement. The Farm Bureau analysis to say that it's like the poorly conditioned barn next door. If the poorly conditioned barn next door has a factor that's doing something to allow the fire to begin, which in this particular case is not to have fed the animals and therefore they don't produce a well, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Respectfully, I thank you for all of your time and attention in this matter. I'm reminded of the comment that I heard from Judge Wood at the Fairchild lecture. I read about that, and Judge Fairchild judged every case he ever heard on whether or not a person had their day in court. NSP, respectfully, didn't have its day in court because these questions weren't put. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ryberg, and thank you, Mr. Lawrence, for your arguments in this stray voltage case, which joins a number of other stray voltage cases we have heard and the one we are about to hear. Thank you, and that concludes our hearing in 2005 AP 1424, Gums versus Northern States Power Company. And as soon as our counsel